If you look at the resource market, though, it's dominated by iron ore, by oil and gas, and by coal, right? And, and that accounts for the vast majority of the market cap of the resource sector. So our view is, if we're, you know, if we're going to be targeting a relatively small part of the market, we need to be high conviction, because if you're not, you have to compromise on quality, right? So what we're trying to do is, if, for example, we're saying we want copper exposure and want that to be 25% of the portfolio. If you can only buy 5% in a stock, and Oz Minerals is a good example, which is our biggest contributor to our results since we started. If we'd only been able to buy 5%, what else would we have bought?
Righto, g'day money miners. Everyone loves a fundy interview. And mate, JD, I reckon we've ripped out a bloody good one.
Mate, I was pretty happy with this one. I think we've got a ripper in store for the money miners. Do you wanna give a bit of an intro, mate?
Righto, Dave Franklin runs the Natural Resource Fund and the Gold Fund yep. for Argonaut.
That's right.
On the buy side of Argonaut. So the fund operates independently from Argonaut. I'm sure they walk through the building and have a yarn and get a few ideas from all the sell side guys. But it operates independently, and they don't. It's not like they exclusively use Argonaut for all the broken. There's same as every other fund, got bloody accounts with everyone and use everyone. So
that's right, mate.
Just got the same brand.
Yeah, and Dave's been around the block. He's been head of research at Hartley Poynton a while back. Lot of experience in the funds management world, and I thought this was a cracker. We talk about the macro setup. Obviously, we're at a pretty intriguing point in time in that regard. We get into specifically what's going on in commodities, how he looks at the commodity setup going forward, and then, you know, the best bit of all, which I think the money miners will really enjoy, we get into so many of the stocks that we speak to on a day-to-day basis that he holds or has held in the past or has an opinion on, and then we round out with a cracking underrated versus overrated, a bit of a spontaneous one as well, mate.
Yeah, just off the cuff, JD. Yeah, we roll. But I did really enjoy, like, and as you explained to me, how he filters the strict filtering to get the stocks that he invests in the fund. Like, as you said, top 46% of the fund is in 5 stocks. So high conviction on these stocks.
That's it. And we get into it in quite a bit of detail, a bit of a different way of building a portfolio to many of the other fundies, and I thought it was an awesome chat that I'm keen to share.
We talk Pilbara Minerals, Develop, MinRes,
De Grey, Gold Road, Orteco, NextGen,
yeah.
And a whole bunch more as well.
Yeah, no, so bloody let's good get into it, mate. Right, for the sponsors for today. Now, look, it's as simple as this, JD. Dave, the Argonaut Natural Resource Fund, and pretty much every other fund out there couldn't do a fucking thing if K-Drill weren't drilling holes into the ground, finding ore. There'd be no ore to talk about. You take K-Drill out of the bloody industry, mining stops,
Matt,
I think.
I've never got any idea where you're going to go with these things.
But isn't it true?
You're dead right. Without drilling, the guys at K-Drill, RC drilling specialists, safe, reliable, the industry comes to a grinding halt.
Mining falls over. It's on 60 Minutes that we've got no phones anymore. Like, that's what happens. So RC drilling experts, give them a buzz. Drop the money in my name. Even the guy at the Barn Me Shop wants to meet Ryan O'Sullivan.
Who doesn't? Who doesn't?
Ryan, can you please go see Q at the Let's Eat Lunch Bar? He really wants to meet you. You're a celebrity.
Awesome. Thanks a lot, KJ.
Thanks, KJ. All right, let's get into our yarn with Dave Franklin from the Argonaut Natural Resources Fund and the Argonaut Gold Fund. Here we go. Right, money miners, here we go. Now, JD, I'm a bit excited about this one. But I think it's because I finally actually did some work towards one of the fun ones instead of you writing all the questions. I feel involved now.
You've chipped in, mate.
Dave Franklin, welcome to Money of Mine, mate.
Thanks, Maddie, and thanks, JD.
Mate, I won't lead the intro because you're in JD's old stomping ground. JD, I'm going to let it over to you, mate.
Let's do it. So obviously we've got Dave Franklin here. He's been running the Argonaut funds management business since the beginning of 2020, so about 3.5 years with a pretty decent track record over that period. So what I think is going to be most interesting to the money miners here is that a lot of the stocks we're going to talk about today are the ones we're talking about every day, you know, the likes of Develop, MinRes, De Grey, Gold Road. We're going to chat about all of them. It's very much in our wheelhouse. Dave is based in Perth. So, you know, with that sort of said, Let's get into it, hey?
Dave, some impressive returns. You may as well bloody fly the flag from the start, mate, since inception, a couple 100%. Have I got that right?
Yeah, since we kicked off in January 2020, the funds is up 205%. Last year we're up, for the financial year, up 27%. The year before that, we're up 35% or so. So track record's been good, but what do I say about funds management? It's what you do going forward rather than what you've done in the past.
Subject to change without notice, isn't it? Yeah. And it's pretty much you can take, when you say the fund, we're talking you, aren't you? You run it by yourself, do you?
Yeah, look, we've got an investment committee and we do have a junior analyst that helps us, but I'm the fund manager. And I think funds management it's not a democracy, right? So in a fund, you need someone that takes responsibility for the decisions. Obviously, you get support with the research that you need to do, but you need to take that that responsibility.
Oh, well, congratulations, mate. Yeah. I'm sure the bloody the people that are in the fund are congratulating you too. Mate, before we start, now we've come across a little photo of yourself and Mr. Edward Rigg, the main man himself. I wouldn't have thought twice about this photo, but I have been told there is a bit of a story behind it. Can you enlighten us? We'll flash it up on screen on YouTube. And for those listening on the potty, it's Eddie and Dave both dressed in a suit, but
yes,
there is a story.
Well, if you look closely, you might suggest that perhaps it's not my jacket. And,
due to four sizes too large.
Exactly. So the ex chief operating officer, Michael Price, who I thought was about my size, wore his jacket in and I didn't have a jacket. So he said, I said, can I wear it? And I put it on and I thought it was okay. But when I looked at the photos afterwards, it's about three sizes too big.
It was a picture for mining news, wasn't it?
To promote, that's right.
The fun.
Exactly.
It wasn't Eddie like, mate, we're finally getting in the news. We're in the news and you haven't even got a bloody jacket.
Exactly.
Oh, very good, mate. Lead her away, JD.
Let's get into it. I want to start with a bit of macro, Dave. So we had for the longest time, it seems, zero interest rates, pretty kind of boring environment. Equities were going up left, right and centre. But we've now got to a sort of point where, you know, it's a bit harder to pick winners. There's a lot more going on. We've seen bond yields and prices flying in you know, certain directions. Interest rates, inflation is all go at the moment. So do you feel as a fund manager this is like a much more challenging, engaging and almost fun time to be in the market?
Yeah, I don't know about fun, but it's certainly more engaging and more challenging. And, I think you've picked it pretty right. I think if you look at the last couple of weeks, what you've seen is the Fed's been out there banging on that, you know, interest rates are going to be higher for longer. And the market hasn't really believed it. Whereas I think what you're seeing now is they're going, actually, this is happening, right? And the 10-year bond yield has kicked up. You know, it's around 4.6, 4.7% in the US. And I think the market's now saying, actually, interest rates aren't coming down for some time. And that's then flowing through to an expectation of perhaps slower global growth than they might have thought. And that's having an impact on commodities. So,
How do you sort of position the portfolio in light of all these things? Were you of that sort of higher for longer view for a while now, or has that sort of been adopted recently by yourself?
Look, I think you've always the way I look at a lot of the macro is observe and react rather than predict, right? Because I think if you look at assumptions that are made, particularly around macro forecasts, you're often wrong. And you look at commodity prices, and we'll talk about that later. You know, you see that a lot, that that people often are very confident about their forecasts, but the accuracy falls short. So,
yeah.
So the way we look at it is to say, let's expect a short, a downturn in the economy next year. How do we want to position the portfolio? Now, there's some commodities that are less exposed to a downturn. So, for example, uranium, rare earths are two commodities where we think they've got good long-term futures, but they're not really going to be impacted by a slowdown in the economy. Whereas copper and nickel and lithium perhaps, are more exposed there. So what we do is we tilt the portfolio towards those commodities that will give us a bit more protection. But then, for example, with copper, the challenge has always been buying the good quality companies at a good price. And obviously when the commodity prices come off, then the share prices come off, and that gives you an opportunity to buy them at good levels.
And so where does gold sit in that either end of the spectrum?
Yeah, well, I think The world's a dangerous place, as we've seen the last couple of days, and obviously Ukraine and Russia, et cetera. So you've got to have, in our view, you've got to have gold in the portfolio. It's a critical component of that. As we've seen recently, you can sit in the portfolio and do very little for a period of time, but when you get an event, it kicks up. So again, you want to be in the good quality, bigger companies, the producers, generating cash in good locations, but gold is an important part of the portfolio.
What you've said there really reminds me of, I think it's Howard Marks, and he said it's the investor's job to not predict the macro future because that's a fool's errand,
yeah,
but to know exactly where we are at the current point in time. And I sort of want to lead that into your conviction around your picks because I've noticed looking through your latest deck, your top five picks make up, I think, roughly 46% of your holdings. And that's a much higher conviction and we see with a lot of the other managers we see out there, you know, they're talking about a 5 or 6% position in a company being a sort of, you know, a career maker. How do you sort of think about gaining conviction around your picks?
Yeah. To put it into some context, if you stand back, right, and you say, well, let's look at the resource market, and you say, you know, one of our key themes is energy transition. And we see that there's a whole new wave of demand going into a relatively small group of commodities, and that's ultimately where we want to be positioned to capitalise on that. If you look at the resource market, though, it's dominated by iron ore, by oil and gas, and by coal, right? And and that accounts for the vast majority of the market cap of the resource sector. So our view is if we're going to be targeting a relatively small part of the market, we need to be high conviction because if you're not, you have to compromise on quality, right? So what we're trying to do is, if for example, we're saying we want copper exposure and want that to be 25% of the portfolio. If you can only buy 5% in a stock, and Oz Minerals is a good example, which is our biggest contributor to our results since we started. If we'd only been able to buy 5%, what else would we have bought, you know? So I think a lot of people diversify because they're trying to minimise risk, but in resources where it's a small universe of stocks you want to own, you got to be careful that you don't actually take more risk by having to diversify the portfolio.
And does that 46%, that conviction, does that change in the macro setting? So if we go into a lower inflationary environment and a lower interest rate environment, would you change that strategy?
Yeah, totally. So one of the things we do, and it's actually driven by, you mentioned Howard Marks, and we kind of look at sort of the approach he took. You got to kind of have a view of where you're at in the market. So in a market like we've got today, we say like there's potential risk out there, but as a fund manager, we don't want to go, you know, way up in cash necessarily. So what we do is we tilt the portfolio towards bigger market cap companies where we know there's greater liquidity and most likely better quality. And so what you'll see in a market like now is the top five will be dominated by bigger market cap companies and will have a bigger position in them for protection. When things loosen up a bit, then opportunities at the small end of town will emerge and we'll take advantage of those.
Do you also look at it as a sort of edge over competitors in the funds management space where they are taking positions of less than 5% and they have to have that many more winners and that many more picks, you know, to be able to, you know, have substantial returns?
Yeah, look, I think different managers have different approaches. And the way I often describe it is we're very systems and processes, right? So it's kind of what are the key themes we think are going to impact on resources? What are the commodities that we think will do best? And what are the best quality, best value companies that produce or want to produce those commodities, right? And we go through that process. The alternative is to look for the next pretty thing. Right, so this undiscovered gem that's early stage is going to find the resource. The resource is going to grow, and you're going to make 10 times your money. We believe they're nice to have, but you can't build a sustainable, repeatable performance on the back of those.
So when you're looking at investing in mining, like this fund is there a bit of a sweet spot on the size of the fund where?
Yeah.
As you mentioned, because like when you're in the smaller ones, like liquidity is the issue.
Yeah.
But gaining exposure and investing all the money, where's the sweet spot?
Well, yeah.
What do you like?
Well, it's a good question. So part of the reason, so I reckon that the optimal size for the Natural Resources Fund and probably the Gold Fund is somewhere around 150 million.
Yeah.
Because once you get above that, you have to then you have to start buying the Rios and the BHPs and et cetera, and you're diluting the ability to target those areas that you think will outperform. So I think that's the optimal size. Having said that, you know, the view we've taken as we've grown is even when we had $5 million, we took the view that we got to manage it like a $100 or $150 million portfolio so that investors get comfort that as the fund gets bigger, we can continue to perform. And that's been pretty important what we've done.
So do you then have to control when you get to that 150 and then say you're compounding at 15% annually, do you have to like then encourage the participants in the fund to take dividends and not reinvest them? Do you like try and maintain that or do you want to keep growing it? It's obviously better for the performance fee, but is that a tough thing to balance?
Well, it'll be a good challenge when we get there, right?
So good problem to have.
Yeah, exactly. It'll be nice, and you know, a lot of particularly in the small cap space, a lot of the funds there sort of say this is where we're stopping, and keep it at that. But that would be a nice issue to have. But we'll deal with it then.
We'll get to that. We'll have you on again about that.
That's right,
Dave. You showed a couple charts in your latest deck, which will flash up on the screen for the YouTube watchers. For those listening in, it essentially shows the top three producers of metals by country. Yeah. And then it's side by side next to the top three processors by country. And what it really shows, in particular in that processing, is how much China dominates. What I want to hear from you is to have you look into your crystal ball and tell us, how does it sort of look in 10 years' time? Do you think it's still going to be China dominating so much of that processing?
Absolutely not. You know, I think you're seeing actions now from the US, EU, UK, and even Australia to lessen that load. So I think it's a trend that's going to continue. It comes back to that, you know, supply chains. And I think really what's happened over the last couple of years is countries stepping back and saying, who do we want to deal with? Who do we want to partner with? Who do we want to buy our raw materials from and who do we want to sell them to? And it's all part of that. I think what that chart shows, though, is that China have been, you know, decades ahead of the rest of the world in building an integrated business around key commodities that would be important going forward.
And another example that comes to mind for me is Indonesia, specifically as it relates to nickel. And this came from a government mandate, and similar to what you just said there with the EU and the US. A lot of it's coming from the government mandate, and it, you know, it worked to really great effect with Indonesia. Do you think it has to come? Like, do you think the free market can sort of make it happen, or it actually has to come through government incentive?
Well, I think government so history would suggest you need some government incentive. You need someone pushing the agenda over and above economics. That's why China were able to do it. And Indonesia took a similar path. They were funded largely by China to get there.
Yeah.
But I think there's a recognition now that what was good in the past is not going to work in the future. So there is a real commitment, and you're seeing it with, you know, if you look at, for example, Iluka and the government loan, they've got $1 billion. I mean, 5 years ago, you wouldn't have thought that was possible. So it's a different world, and I think there's a recognition of that. So the final point I make on this chart, if I can kick
absolutely
in there.
It's bloody your show today, Dave. Yeah. You do whatever you want, Cobber.
You know, when I show this slide, the points we just talked about are a critical one. But the other thing from a funds management perspective is what we're trying to do is we're trying to find resources that are not in most of these countries, right? Ideally, we want to find them in tier one locations, and we want them with the ability to be processed somewhere outside China. So that will limit, to some extent, some of the commodities which you might think are well placed for energy transition, but due to those characteristics, we might not go there.
That helps helps if you only want to pick five, doesn't it? Yeah. Having good filters that really narrow it down.
Yeah, exactly.
And we'll probably get into that as well.
Yeah.
Moving on, there's another chart that you show, and that's focused on the consensus commodity outlooks. And it reflects, I think, eight different commodities, all your base metals and the like. What I want to hear from you is, are there any commodities in that chart where you feel you've got a contrarian sort of view, a view that differs from what the majority think?
Yeah. I think the consensus outlooks for a lot of the charts are really interesting, right? Because We typically show the chart with another chart, which shows the demand outlook for key commodities for energy transition to happen. And copper is a really good example, right? So copper market's about, you know, 24 million tonnes per annum, and it's due to grow to, you know, say 40 million tonnes by 2035. So massive growth, right? Supply is constrained. A lot of it comes from Chile and Peru. A lot of social unrest there and high chance of disruption. So you go, demand looks good, supply is constrained, prices should go up. You look at the consensus and it goes pretty much flat for the next 5 years, right? So 6 months ago, it was probably around $9,000 a tonne. It's now forecast to be $10,000 a tonne in 5 years' time. Now, to me, what that says is one of a number of things. One is energy transition is not going to happen, or two, that these prices are way undercooked. And you'd suggest that for demand or supply to increase to meet demand, you're going to need higher prices. So our view with a lot of these commodities, and copper is probably the standout, is the market is underpricing where copper can be. And why might that be, right? I think you've been an analyst, and I've certainly been an analyst in the past. Often as an analyst, there's no real benefit in sticking your neck out and making big forecasts, you know, 5 years out. So I think that's one of the factors which plays into that. Yeah. So the final point I'm making that is that then flows through to, you know, the DCF type valuations, you know, and the assumptions they're making. So often we take a view that if you buy a good quality company and it's looking fairly priced on consensus numbers, it's probably actually a bit better than that because the commodity price forecasts are a bit on the low side.
And it looks like in the last couple of months alone, you've sort of really altered the cash balance in the portfolio. And from what I can sort of surmise, that a lot of that's gone into copper exposure. Is that really on the basis of what you said, or more a sort of stock specific type of analysis?
Yeah. So we can move cash around a bit. And maybe running through it. So copper, as we kind of touched on earlier, what we wanted to do was build good quality copper exposure, but in a market where copper prices may well weaken. So there was kind of a value opportunity to get stocks, but we need to be protected. So the stocks that we've bought were Metals Acquisition Corp, and the benefit of that is, as I think you guys are aware, it's listed in the US, owns the CSA mine in Cobar. It'll then transition to listing on the ASX. It's trading on an EBITDA multiple 4 or 5 times versus, you know, Sandfire, which is probably the best comparison of 7 or 8, right? So we can kind of see there's a value benefit there as it comes across, and we think it'll ultimately be the standout copper producer. If you look at Teck, which is our other copper producer, it's got a coal business and a copper business. They're looking to split those at some point. Corporate activity is highly likely, so we see a bit of downside protection there.
You're giving me lots to go on there. All right, let's double click on Metals Acquisition Corp.
Yeah.
So you mentioned you like it and the reasons why, the valuation, the multiple. Mm. We did a bit of a deep dive on it a couple months ago, and one of the other aspects that really stood out was the nature of the funding, the heavy debt funding, the sort of incentives in and around SPAC, SPACs in general, although that's kind of behind it now. And there was also the streaming. So how do you sort of weigh up the company's ability to, you know, service that debt in a sort of weaker copper price environment?
Look, you know, the way I look at it is it's going to move to Australia, and Australian institutions are looking for high quality copper exposure. So it's going to be a mine that ultimately produces somewhere between 40 and 50,000 tonnes per annum. It's high grade. It's very deep, obviously, but I think the infrastructure is in place. I think the capital structure will be rectified as it goes through that process in listing in Australia. So it's not optimal.
A big equity raise.
Yeah, yeah. Yep.
What's the talk on the town with exploration potential there, or are they just following it down?
I think there's a lot of exploration potential. You know, often with assets that are managed by some of the commodity traders, you know, they're more focused on the output rather than developing the project. So I think that's what they're busily doing now. And I think there's good upside from that.
I think, and we'll talk about copper companies again, but just copper specifically, here two trains of thought. Do you think it's going to be the supply, the lack of supply that is what's going to see the uptick in copper, or are we going to have to see the lift in demand before that's going to actually drive the lift in copper? Because obviously at the moment with, you know, global interest rates rising, global growth, that's obviously usually not helping copper, which is what we're seeing now. What do you think is going to be the catalyst?
Well, I think you're right. It's, if you look at where the new wave of demand is coming from, it's energy transition, and that's got to drive the increase in demand and force up prices and drive supply. So the way we look at copper is short term outlook is uncertain, because you will get some substitution from typical normal markets into the energy transition market. But over the medium term, demand will drive that increased supply.
We will revisit copper later. I've got a good one. I'm looking forward to getting into Orteco. So 15% of, whenever I usually ask a question here, Dave, JD's written it. Anyway, I'll take that. 15% of the portfolio is in lithium. Thanks for that, JD.
Yeah.
Pilbara Minres Global Lithium.
What are we thinking?
Especially considering Pilbara's up there, usually the most shorted stock on the ASX at the moment.
Yeah. So lithium, to put it into context, you know, lithium has been a big contributor to the fund's performance really since inception. At times we've had, you know, up to 25% of the portfolio in lithium, and typically in the bigger, better quality names. Over the last few months, we've kind of bounced around. I think in August, we went back into Pilbara and maintained our holding in Minres. And they had a bit of a bounce. I think what we've seen really as we moved into September, you know, into October, is prices start to come off. So we've reduced our exposure a bit there. But I think the point I'd make is this. I think that lithium prices are probably near their bottom. If you look at the spodumene price, around $3,000 US a tonne, we don't think there's a whole lot of downside. Maybe 2,500, but at that kind of level, you have the lepidolite producers, bumping up against their costs. Demand will still be very strong. You've got a market that's going to probably triple in size in the next next 7 or 8 years.
So do you think when we feel the heat come off lithium a bit, as we have in the last, probably fortnight or so, do you think we're just going to be in and out, but it's just going to keep seeing frequent spikes, or are we just going to see a gradual increase? How do you see that whole, the lithium commodity interest playing out?
What's really different about lithium is – it's a new industry. It's come from nothing, right? So it's very immature.
Very quickly.
So it's gone from nothing to, roughly 1 million tons of lithium carbonate equivalent, and it's going to go to 3 million. So what that means is you just get wild spikes in demand exceeding supply, and then supply exceeding demand, and commodity prices going everywhere. And the perfect example of that is Pilbara, right? So if you look at Pilbara last year, their EBITDA margin was 82%. Now, that's incredible, and the reason that happened was they were a first mover, they were in there, they had all the supply when prices were going through the roof, and they could capitalise on that. I think what you'll see over the next 10 years is a stabilisation of the market, but it is still small, and I think it's working in reverse a bit now. You've got supply exceeding demand, and that's crunching price. So I think there's a bit to go through until it reaches maturity. It's probably 5 years away, so you have some volatility in the interim, but... what's interesting is we're watching a new industry and ultimately a bulk commodity or bulk chemical developing before our eyes.
Yeah, we got told that by Joe. Lowry says it's a chemical, it's not a commodity. And with Pilbara, being the most, the most shorted stock at the moment, why is it? Have they got it wrong? Are people, bigger instos funds using it as a lithium hedge, that position? How do you see it?
I think sentiment is a big part of it. So, but if part of the risk with Pilbara is its last year's result was so incredibly strong, right? So I think as we move into the quarterlies, the lithium companies, and particularly the ones that are in production, are going to be comparing probably pretty similar or higher production but most likely a significantly lower price. So their headline results will look bad, and everyone will come out and say, well, lithium prices are falling substantially. But I think you almost kind of need to stand back and say that was pretty abnormal what happened in the past, and let's, because margins will still be pretty good even on the current lithium prices.
And yeah, on MinRes, sorry, yep. JD, I'm on a bloody roll here. MinRes, because I think it was one quarter ago, or maybe two, when they had there's a bit of the heated investor call when the a couple of the research institutions, Jarden claiming they were going to have 2 years of negative free cash flow, and obviously Mr. Ellison doesn't like those sort of comments. And look, they're $59 today, so they've sort of broke down again today. Like, how do you lot of plans in the pipeline, but we don't know what the plans are because he keeps his cards close to his chest and then drops them on everyone. He's got $1.1 billion worth of US bonds of recent. Give us a bit of take on them.
Yeah, it's I think to understand MinRes, you've got to look at where they've come from, right? And I dug up a 2008 annual report from MinRes. They just reported a profit of $49 million, and they had something like 130 million shares on issue, right? 15 years later, the net profit was almost 800 million, and they had 185 million shares on issue. So, it's a company that's gone from a market cap of, something like 100 mil to a market cap of, 12 billion, raising virtually no equity, right? And I can't think of many companies that have been able to do that. And it's a phenomenal effort. So I think it's in his DNA to where he's investing in assets where he sees the return on capital being very high to limit the amount of equity. And at times like this, where you've got major growth avenues across all parts of his business, it potentially means he takes on more debt than some people in the market would like. But I think you got to back him. You got a mining service business, which is probably the best mining service business in the world, 500 million EBITDA going to a billion over the next couple of years. You've got a lithium business, which again will double in size. A bit of work to be done as far as, lifting production, keeping costs down and all that. But ultimately, he's got among the best hard rock lithium assets in the world. The iron ore, Onslow Iron Ore is also coming on stream. That'll lift their production from what it was in the past, 20 million tonnes to 40 million tonnes at much lower cost. And then you've got the gas story, which is probably a bit more unknown, but has the ability to reduce your operating costs across the group. So, my view is you've got to back the man with MinRes. And I'm sure 5 years' time it's going to be a pretty interesting story.
So I think at $59, it'd be sparking your interest on the buy side, I'd assume.
It will. I mean, you always got to be careful about, timing your interest and your entry. But it's one we like, yeah.
Yeah, it's not somebody I'd bet against any time.
No, God, no.
Yeah.
Dave, you mentioned tech earlier as well in the context of copper. They've also got the ongoing sort of fighting, I guess, with Glencore. They seem to be flipping them off a bit lately. And the latest rumours I'd heard is that they were looking to sell the met coal business to JSW, the Indian group. And I'm curious how much of a part that catalyst kind of plays in your reason for being in tech, the potential re-rate on the back of being much more of a metals business minus coke and coal.
Yeah, look, ultimately what attracted us to tech was the copper assets. If you look at them, their production over the next couple of years will go from, about, 350,000 tonnes to about, 650,000 tonnes, something like that. So the growth profile for a sizable copper producer is probably the best in the world, right? Obviously some production out of South America, which has some risk, but also a lot from North America. So that's really what attracted us to it. We see the fact that it's wrapped up in a convoluted structure, with the coal asset alongside that, it gives us some protection because one of the commodities actually holding up pretty well is coke and coal. So on the coke and coal side, it's generating good cash, but also commodity price-wise, it's holding up, which is good. And then you're right, something will happen, whether it's a split or a sale, and we see that that'll unlock value. The group's trading on an EBITDA multiple of about 5x. You'd argue that the coal asset's probably worth slightly less than that and the copper's worth slightly more. So we think net-net there'll probably be a net benefit. It's just an added way to protect the portfolio where we can get good quality copper exposure but protect ourselves from just, from what's happening in the copper market at the moment.
Gotcha. There's another commodity we have to ask you about. It's all the rage at the moment and the money miners are itching for us to talk more about it. It's uranium. So you've sort of thrown your hat in the ring with NexGen and, you know, we've heard ad nauseum about the quality of the Arrow deposit and on. I'm keen to hear more about the commodity to start with and whether it's just playing out as you'd kind of expected and how, you know, without forecasting the future, you see things unfolding.
Yeah, I think if you look at what's happened over the last 12 months in particular, uranium to really come into the mix. And I think there's a recognition that it's an important part of energy transition and it's going to have a role. I don't think it's not the commodity. I think it's part of the mix. I think you'll probably still need gas in some circumstances. But uranium, I think there's a recognition that it'll be part of the energy mix going forward, which I think is good. What we like about NexGen is the quality of it, as you touched on, a big resource in tier one location. Environmentally, they're planning very well. The way they've dealt with First Nations has been very good. Its grade is high, and we think it'll emerge as one of the major players in the uranium space. Compared to a lot of the list, it's hard to find good quality in the uranium sector, where often they need prices above where they are today. You know, probably approaching $80 a pound to make them economic. Whereas NexGen will be a low cost producer. So
yeah, I've seen a lot of the brokers. You know, they go from doing NAV analysis to NAV plus a multiple to NAV plus an even bigger multiple.
Yeah,
and you know some of those numbers on a lot of the ASX players are just they're getting pretty carried away. The valuations like. To the point where you think, oh, I'd look at the Uranium Physical Trust as opposed to playing these sorts of names. I'm not sure if you've got a take on that.
Well, the benefit of investing in the companies is the leverage that you get from price increases, which you don't really get in the trusts, right, where they're holding the physical asset. So we actually owned Yellow Cake for a little while, but we just thought, well, if we're going to be in it, then we might as well go with the equities, yeah. The only other points I'd make on uranium, though, is, again, I think it's kind of it's a medium-term opportunity because I think supply ultimately will ramp up pretty quickly. Because there are a lot of projects that have been mothballed. I think the technology will improve so they can process some of the old waste. It's such an efficient fuel that I don't think there'll be a shortage. So in some respects, a bit like lithium, you're going to see demand kick up and supply will struggle to catch up and there'll be a bit of a spike. But long term, I'm not sure the price will stay up at extreme levels.
What do you think about the in-situ leaching projects like what Boss are bringing online in terms of probably a perception thing more than anything? You're not blasting it, you're not doing anything, I think. Do you think there's going to be a lot of appeal for projects like that? Because they're going to print some cash, I think, when they get going.
Yeah, look, I think so. I think projects that are easy, you can generate cash relatively quickly and the environmental footprint is less, that's all going to be good. So, and the market will like that. The final point I'd make on uranium, though, is the whole nuclear element to it, right? So the risk out there is you get Putin doing something silly and lobbing a missile on a nuclear power plant in Ukraine, right? Or you've also got a nuclear proliferation from countries like North Korea and Iran and stuff. So you can't disregard the risk that this commodity has over and above some others.
Mate, we want to go. We're going to go gold, then we're going to go to gold copper mix, then we're going to go to copper, and no doubt Gina and Ellison will get another mention as well.
Yeah.
Mate, you got De Grey as one of your favourite favourite gold picks. We went through the DFS the other day.
Yeah.
It was a really interesting one, and I want to talk about the capex. So look, the capex went up from 1.05 billion to 1.35 billion. But look, one thing that sort of drew my attention for that is this POX, pox train. So they've got an 800,000 tonne per annum pox train. And now the info I've found is Russia's Polymet, Polymetal International in 2019 quoted, they put in 250 to 300,000 tonne per annum second pox train, and they said the pre-production capex for that was US$431 million. And then De Grea claiming they're going to do, they got over double that in pox train capacity.
Yeah.
And they're saying they're going to do it for $1.35 billion. What do you think of that capex number?
I mean, it's a tough time at the moment to build anything. Technically, I don't have the same background that perhaps you do in those kind of projects. So
I've got nothing. I blew up rocks underground. Yeah. So, yeah, no, this was literally off ChatGPT.
Yeah, yeah.
No, the internet.
So, so you would assume they've been well advised on what the capex will be. But having said that, what we're seeing really with every major project is capex requirements are blowing out. Mm-hmm. I think as an investor, the view we take is a 550,000 ounce per annum producer in a tier one location and close to infrastructure is pretty appealing, and we think it will appeal to a number of groups, and I think the technology and the infrastructure will get there. In all likelihood, it'll cost more than what they think it to cost, but I think there's enough valuation upside to counter that.
Yeah. When did you get it? You've been in De Grey for a while before DFS?
Yeah. So we've been in and out of it a number of times, and then we participated in a small way in the capital raise, which was just done, but we've had an existing position for a long time.
Yeah.
And what do you make of the 5% discount rate?
It's too low. Yeah. Yeah.
Those days are gone.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it doesn't, and people are still doing it, which is annoying. But and again, I think you guys have talked on the relevance of DCF calculations, when you have those kind of assumptions. So we also try to, we try and look at the valuation in a number of different ways. And one is to say, well, if this was in production today, producing 550,000 ounces, what would the market rate it at, right? And we kind of work back that as a bit of a check.
Yeah. And how do you look at an investment in De Grey? Because I could ask questions about the mixing of oxide transitional refractory and the processing, but are you looking at as an investment at the moment as a transaction, like for someone to take them over? Like what's the exit strategy on De Grey? Or is it a long-term investment view?
It's a good question, and I think you've got to consider everything, right? So the way I'd look at it is to step back a bit. If you look at the gold sector, what we've seen recently is smaller, newer mines, say a Capricorn or a Gold Road, are rated at the highest because they're new, right? So their OPEX is low, their CAPEX is low, and they've got long mine lives, right? And so you've got Gold Road trading about, $8,000 enterprise value per ounce of production, right? And you've got Capricorn at, say, $12,000. Capricorn's a bit different because it's also got Mount Gibson coming on, right, which has some value. So if you said, well, De Grey should trade probably as something like that, and given the scale, it might even trade at a premium. So if you said it's at $10,000 enterprise value per ounce of production, 550,000 ounces per year, you're talking about an asset that's ultimately worth $5.5 billion. Yep. And so then we go, well, if it's worth $5.5 billion, it's got to raise probably $1 billion in equity. It's got to raise $1.5 billion in funding, say 500 equity, a billion in debt. What price do you raise the equity at? And so you come up with a sort of an equity value of the project. And then you discount that back to today and you say, well, here's the kind of return that I expect per annum. But clearly, its current market cap, say, 1.8. The capital is 1.5, so that's, 3.3, and potentially there's a value of 5.5, right? But you got to wait some time, and there's also a risk. So we factor that in as well. So that's the kind of way we look at it. Having said that, typically when a project is actually about to commission, they're probably the times you don't want to own it, right? Because if something's going to go wrong, that's when it's going to become available, become public. So we'll kind of, we think there's some upside now. Bellevue's a really good example. The market is now valuing it as if it's going to be a major producer you know, at that, at those kind of levels.
So, sort of priced to perfection.
Yeah, exactly. So we've owned it for a long time. We step back. Ideally, we'll re-enter it once it's all settled down.
So anyway. is that the top down reverse approach you were explaining to me, JD, about how you that's how the filter works.
Yeah.
To find everything back calc and from.
Yeah.
These valuations.
Yeah. I mean, you still look at you know, at DCF calculations and all that kind of stuff, but I think the problem with the DCF is you're going to make big assumptions. You're going to say, well, what's the gold price going to be over the next 20 years? What's the exchange rate going to be? And what discount rate do you want to use? Whereas here you're just going, well, what would the market value at today? And then you work back from there. So,
David, love to see if we could sort of draw a prediction out of you. So we've touched on Gold Road. They own just under 20%
of De Grey. Took the words right out of my mouth, JD.
And we've been obviously speaking about a takeout. Who do you think does the eventual takeout if that's the way it goes?
Or does it happen?
It's a good question. You know, and I don't really have any great insights there. Does it even matter to you?
Like from an investment point of view, who takes it?
Yeah, I think you've always got to be careful buying a stock on the expectation someone's going to take it out and pay you a premium. And perhaps we'll talk about Liontown a bit, you know, along the similar lines. Mm. So to me, it's got to stand up on its own. And then if that happens, well and good. But, you know, you'd suggest it's a Barrick or it's a Goldfields or Agnico, you know, one of those majors you would expect. But I wouldn't, you know, it's not the reason we bought it.
Because they'll all pay 30%, so it doesn't matter. Yeah. You don't make more money to pay if it's Barrick or as long as they pay 30%, who cares, really?
Yeah, exactly.
From an investment standpoint.
Yeah.
Another stock that I've seen you hold is Auteco. We had a dive into them.
This is the gold copper transition. it's all planned.
Yeah.
So it was probably a month ago they did the transaction, and that's really sort of, I mean, the way we spoke about it was Auteco 2.0. They had their big run-up in share price.
Rebirth.
Yeah. Yep, and then they've done this transaction. So they've really branded it as a much more of a copper focus as opposed to the gold focus they'd previously had. And the way we'd sort of drawn the picture was that this is a real exploration play. They did have infrastructure, but the decline was a bit small. The mill was pretty far away from the asset itself. Mm. Just to start with, how do you view it? Do you look at it in the same light as the way we did?
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. I think, again, standing back and looking at it, you go, firstly, it's got a reasonable resource. I think 40 million tonnes at just under 2%, right? So that's pretty good, right? It's got an infrastructure in place. Importantly, it's in a tier one location, and it's got all permitting and approvals in place, right? So you go, okay, this could be a 40,000 tonne per annum producer, you know, reasonably quickly. But where copper prices are now, I think they're doing the right thing, is you might as well stand back, develop it, and it will do some more drilling and exploration, try and build up the resource and really work out what you've got. And given the management group sort of come from sort of the Bellevue stable, it's really what happened there. So I think it makes a lot of sense. You stand back, you do a lot more work, you really understand what you've got, and then you identify the best way to develop it, get the good people in, and move it forward. So
it's like you've read the question Maddie's going to ask. Yeah,
right. Do you think that actually be able to get it developed that quickly? Like, considering that decline is, you know, I think it's suited for 30-ton trucks, and the mill, essentially the mill is small and suits the size of the decline. So if they'd essentially have to develop a whole new decline a kilometre deep, which would take, bloody long time, and then upgrade the mill and everything. Do you think they'd actually be able to, if they chose, which they're not going to, it's an exploration play, but it looks like a lot of time and capital would be required to get this thing up to an Australian, not Australian standard, an Australian output standard, a high output.
Yeah. Look, I think you're probably right. I'm sure, given the price they bought it for, it's going to come with some issues.
Yeah.
But if you look at it, if you compare it with other similar, the issue is there's not many similar opportunities of that scale of project at that grade anywhere in the world, particularly in tier one locations, right? So, you know, often you're either looking at something at a much bigger scale in areas where you're not sure you want to be, Or, you know, as we've seen in Australia, it's hard work to find a project that at the value that could deliver the same kind of returns.
So these, yeah. like, because this is the, as you said, the Parsons, Naylor, Shorex sort of crew. They've got lots of, had lots of vessels, got lots of vessels together. And as I said, like, because this stock went from 2 to 23 cents. Now it's eroded back to 3 cents due to, you know, Pickle Crow had a, it's had and still has that inferred mineral resource because they can only drill from surface. So, it's and the North American gold flavor changed. It was the hot thing, then it wasn't the hot thing.
Yeah,
I guess, and they're very open about in the investor call, and like that's sort of their mandate is dressing these projects up with exploration for a sale. Like they're not, but I guess you look at Bellevue. They sort of did that, but no one bought it.
Yeah, that's
and
right.
And then they had to. They obviously recruited a lot of the ex Northern Star people. What happens if they do take the same approach with this, but no one wants to buy it?
Well, the good thing as an investor, right, is you can always say, well, it's time for me to go.
Yeah.
Right. So, you know, you make an assumption when you come in, and. And the way it looks to me, it's a good resource at a good grade. Work to be done. They'll drill it out. If copper prices move higher, which we think they will, it'll be worth a lot more. But you've always got that right to reassess and change your mind.
And with the Parsons, I'll call them the Parsons crew. Sorry, Ray and Mick, that I'm using Parsons as the title. But you know they can get capital. Raise capital very easily. They've got a good, good following, so they can raise capital easy. They can get the rigs spinning, and they get the hype. But like, do you essentially like believe in that Ateco story, or is there an element of following like individuals like that can really get the capital following?
Well, they're both important, right? Yeah. So you want to think this is a decent project, and getting the right people behind it is going to make it succeed. But you raise a really good point, right? So backing people that have a good track record and have the support of the market is incredibly valuable, because when you're developing something, one of the big inputs is how much capital you need to raise and what price can you raise it at. And, you know, Genesis is a really, really good example where Raleigh coming in, he could raise equity at significantly higher prices with essentially the same group of assets. And Bill Beamont's obviously the same, right? So you can't undervalue the ability to have the market support. But you're only going to get that market support if you've delivered value in the past.
Perfect segue into William Beamont, that one.
Your dear friend Matty. Mr. Bill Beamont. So
he gave me my first job over here. Yeah, right. Yeah, wouldn't he? He probably regrets it now. Yeah. Sorry, Bill.
So Dave, you've backed him in develop. The essential transaction looks like it's
Have a sip of water, mate, if you want. You get a bit parched doing these podcasts.
So the essential transaction looks like it's going to get over the line in the next months or so. So I want to start this one by just asking your thoughts on Woodlawn and Sulphur Springs, talking about assets and people that are backable and stuff.
Yeah. I think Woodlawn looks like a pretty decent asset. It needs the right kind of market. So whether you'd sort of launch in right now with zinc and copper prices with our, you probably wouldn't. So I think doing more work and drilling makes some sense. Sulphur Springs is probably a step or two behind that. But if you take a view that energy transition is going to happen, commodity prices are going to be higher, they're good assets to have in the portfolio, and you'll develop them when it makes sense to develop.
And then on the sort of traffic light dynamic you had in your presentation, you had a catalyst, and it was for contract win. And obviously they've got their sort of mining services type part of the business. But how do you sort of balance the mining services with the actual mining part of the business with develop?
Yeah, well, it's really the MinRes sort of playbook, isn't it? That's what he's looking to develop. And what you'd like to see is him building up the mining services business, generating a good income stream, which then enables him to fund the mine development. So that's kind of the plan. Really, at this stage, a lot of it is backing the people, and we think they're worth backing. But they need They need to win some more contracts. Obviously, they've done a very good job at Bellevue. I think they're very selective in the kind of projects they're going to look for. I think the whole concept around targeting or creating an industry leader in underground mining makes a whole lot of sense. So I think they're doing everything right. What they need is a strong commodity market where these projects become a bit more economic.
Do you think if they, though, started winning contracts, and I'm not sure how many they were obviously going for the Liontown one, and I think it's a good thing that they didn't win it because that would have chewed up all their good people, all their resources to try and service that contract. As you know, contracting is a high risk, low margin sort of game. But when when you got Pioneer Dome potentially coming to the forefront too, once the Essential deal comes over, you got Woodlawn, and I'm sure they're on the hunt for other assets as well. Do you think winning contracts would take those boutique personnel away, because they're a finite amount of good operators, away from them servicing their own assets? Because they'd make more money, wouldn't they, servicing their own assets better than someone else's on a low margin?
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's certainly that's, I think, the decision, why the decision on Liontown was made. I think they've got to be very selective. And you're right, it's always going to be a trade-off between do we divert these people to our existing project or to our projects so that we know that they're done optimally, or do we look to add some income streams which help fund those projects? Mm. You know, I think they'll deal with that on a case-by-case basis.
Do you think we'll start seeing the – I know Bill talked about it initially when he presented Develop to the World, the rebrand, and a lot of it was around – contract equity arrangements, like doing a punching in a decline for a company for a bit of equity in the company, and like those sort. Do you think we're going to start seeing those sort of arrangements? I know you talked about them early, and because they've got the capital and they can deploy capital easily to do things like that. I think that, and that's something that would sort of separate him from the market.
Yeah. So I haven't heard a lot of that discussion recently, but you could argue that if the equity market gets tougher and it's harder to raise funds, something like that becomes more doable and more attractive.
I want to talk about the lithium consolidation underway in WA and this supposed superpower WA Lithium Co.
Is it underway? we don't know. Something's going on.
Through our rampant speculation, Maddie, it sure is underway. So let's start, at the most logical spot. What do you think Gina is ultimately plotting at with her now, 16-17% stake in Liontown?
It's like a crystal ball in itself you need for this one, don't you?
Well, yeah, exactly. So, I think the one thing it says is Gina wants exposure to tier one lithium assets, right? So fundamentally that's it. Now, what's she going to do with, 17 or 18%? Is she going to make a high bid, or is she just there to stop the scheme of arrangement going forward? My guess is she's there to stop the scheme of arrangement going forward. She's probably taking a view that Liontown needs more funding, and she's thinking maybe I can help with that.
And what do you think happens to Liontown if she is successful in, stopping the scheme going through?
Well, I think it keeps doing, it could always just continue with her as a significant shareholder.
But do you reckon it'd be $3? But do you reckon
it wouldn't be. No. So again, talking if you look at the valuation applied to Liontown at $3 versus for example a Pilbara, Pilbara looks very cheap.
Scoop up Pilbara, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
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 I mean, we're talking exactly about that part of the Lassonde curve where you're at the most, subject to the most amount of risk.
Well, exactly right. Yeah, exactly. So
a lot different to Bellevue.
Yeah.
Commissioning their process plant with a chucking, we talked about it today, just chucking fresh rock in a cyanide leach circuit, whereas Liontown, you've got everything, DMS, flotation, tantalum recovery, then a paste plant coming out the back of that.
Yeah.
4 million tonnes per annum.
And 4 million tonnes of it. Totally different.
Mm.
All right, let's take this speculation one step further, like we've been doing for a month now. Do you think there's anything to the rumour that I think we started between Chris and Gina Anything in there?
Oh, someone else. I started the Bill Beam and Ellison one.
Yeah.
Not the Gene.
It doesn't matter. Yeah. Just claim it, mate. Yeah.
You know, the simple answer is I don't know. It wouldn't surprise me given the transactions they've both been involved with in the past. I'm sure that if Gina ended up as a major shareholder in Liontown, there'll be discussions about how they could add value between the groups. But is there a grand plan that's locked away? Wouldn't know.
Yeah. And do you see they've obviously developed a relationship in a way to start taking on the Fortescues and the BHPs and the Rios? Like,
yeah.
Like, you know, we saw them, it the Port joint JV and the Port up in for the iron ore? That was their first sort of dealing together.
Yeah, and I mean, they're side by side with a lot of JVs and everything, in and around Delta that had tenements touching up on each other.
Yeah.
So I've got one more question, Dave, and it's something I noticed in your deck. I thought it was actually really, really cool. You showed some of your best investments and also some of your worst ones. Mm. And one of the ones on the list that didn't work out was Syrah. I think I'm pronouncing that right. That one right, Maddie. First of all, what was the sort of thesis here? We've spoken about it a couple of times. Graphite seems very sort of hard to us. Yeah. Why didn't it kind of play out as you'd anticipated?
Yeah, so we did a lot of work on graphite and we thought we'll just dip our toe in the water and see. We thought it was potentially a bit early, but our toe got bitten off, right? So it was pretty painful. So our thesis on graphite is ultimately it's a key component of batteries. At the moment, supply exceeds demand, so price is depressed. As you saw from the chart we talked about, as far as raw material and processing, very dominated by China. So a lot not to like about the structure, but ultimately it's a resource that's going to be required. So, and Syrah are really the first mover. You know, they've got it's all about having a decent resource and having a processing facility, and they've kind of funded that, notwithstanding there's more funding required. So they seemed like the one to have a look at.
And for sort of lessons for us to learn without getting our toes bitten off, is graphite in the too hard basket now, you know, end of story, or would you still consider graphite going forward?
You probably, I think you want to see pricing go up, right?
Yeah.
Trying to pick when the market might turn, I think is difficult. The issues with the broader market are, one, most of the new production is coming from areas you've got to be cautious about investing in, right? So it's Mozambique, it's Madagascar, it's Tanzania. And then almost all the processing is done in China. So what you've seen is a whole lot of projects get to a stage where they haven't been able to raise capital because the banks and the financiers are saying the dynamics don't make any sense. You've also got the split between fines and large flake, and fines is the lower priced product, and that's used in batteries. But the cost of production is currently above what you can sell the fines for. So a whole lot of structural issues. Then you've got synthetic graphite versus natural graphite. So you can produce it synthetically, which also has an impact on the market.
And one more part I'm intrigued by is, how did you get to the point where you realised, I need to cut my losses and, say that's enough? How did you get sort of arrive there?
Yeah. It's, if I look back in the last couple of months, what are my best investment decisions? It was actually getting rid of a couple like that, where you just go, okay, this hasn't worked. Prices are still weak. And what happened is not only, it's a company that was burning a lot of cash. So it's debt, and so there's some debt in there. It just looked difficult, and you just go, okay, I'm prepared to say I got that one wrong. I'll step back. I think I know the industry quite well. I made a poor decision about going in at that time, but cut the losses and move on. And I think that was good. We had some similar examples where we owned a company called Cooper Energy, which had been a long time. Structurally, you'd say this makes a whole lot of sense. Shortfall of gas on the East Coast, they got gas and they got a processing facility just offshore. It should all make sense. But some issues regarding one of the processing facilities, and then also a pretty major rectification work on some of their mines. And we just stood back and said, the risk is too high, because you can always go back in, right? But once you're in there, you're worrying about it all the time. So selling's a critical part of and accepting that you've made a mistake and moving on is a critical part.
You would have been 300%.
Yeah.
We're going to do a quick overrated, underrated, JD.
Yeah.
Geez, off the top of your head?
Off the top of the head.
Yeah.
We'll go one for one.
One for one.
So overrated, underrated, just one word.
Yeah.
Or neutral.
Yeah.
All right, let's start her up. Oz Gold.
Fairly rated.
Okay. Genesis.
Underrated.
See, this is I've practiced years without prep them questions, JD. That's why they're rolling, mate. Red 5.
Overrated.
Sovereign Metals.
Overrated.
Patriot Battery Metals at a dollar on the CDIs now.
I'd say fairly rated.
Northern Minerals.
Underrated.
Strandline.
Overrated.
Oh, geez, now I'm falling by the wayside, JD.
Iluka.
Underrated.
Paladin.
Overrated.
Good.
Yeah. Calidus.
Overrated.
Atlantic Lithium.
Fairly rated.
Piedmont Lithium.
Overrated.
Sayona.
Overrated.
Metals X.
Ooh. I'll say fairly rated.
Last one for me, AIC Mines.
It's probably underrated.
Has fallen off a fair bit.
Yeah.
Old Lawson would be going off because I left him to last or forgot about you. Spartan.
Underrated.
Yeah, very good. Perfect. Mate, that was friggin' sensational.
That was awesome. Really appreciate your time and you coming on the show, Dave.
No, thank you. Appreciate the opportunity.
I'm stinging for a beer. So it's a good, as I said, 3:30 interview, mate. It's perfect for us. Let's enjoy a coldie. That was, mate, really appreciate that. That was absolutely awesome.
Great.
So awesome.
Hey, Drew.
Cheers, Dave. Thank you.
Cheers.
Mate, how was that?
Fucking brilliant.
That was great.
What a ripping bloke. And just, you know what it made me think? Like, you know, I asked a lot of specific operational questions and things like that. And look, but when they filter stocks based on, you know, these the metrics that he filters on and the valuation and everything, like sometimes it makes you think that maybe you overthink some things sometimes. Like, and look, he's made, you know, a couple hundred percent in a few years.
Yeah, that's it.
I think it's that mandate. And sometimes it's simple is better. The market tells you the price.
And like he said, you know, it doesn't really matter what's happened in the past anymore. You got to go forward as an investor. And I think it's great. He was open to debate on a lot of the stocks. Like we said at the beginning, there are a lot of the companies we talked about quite a bit in the past. We've got a sort of opinion on various ones, and it's great to get a bit of pushback, a bit of debate on them, weigh up the merits, weigh up the challenges being faced. So I thought it was an awesome chat, and I hope the Money Miner's got as much value as we did.
Well, and I always think based on his returns, I'm more inclined to think he's right and I'm wrong usually. So I'll just go with what he thinks because that's pretty. But
we're all on a learning curve, mate.
As you said, when you got smaller amount, that's funds just started. So it's not one of the bigger funds in the Australian resource sector. So look, it's probably easier to go 200% returns in a few years on a smaller fund than like say, but still very, very impressive.
Yeah, and you've got to build
because of the liquidity and everything like that.
Yeah, and you've got to build a track record to attract capital in that sort of business. So that's what the sort of industry they operate in.
Yeah, good stuff, mate. Thanks to all the partners. Cadrill at the top of the show, keeping mining alive, and also plenty of other people keeping mining alive on the list, JD.
Anytime Exploration Services.
Oh, just compliment Cadrill. Terra Capital keeping the investing in mining alive.
That's it. SMEC powering the mining businesses out there.
Powering mining. SMEC leave, no power, no mining. Done. And JP Search, no one to analyse mining.
Yep.
If you take them out of the mix.
Yep, key component, eh?
We only partner with people that if you take them away from mining falls over. That is the filter we use. Money Miners.
On that note, hootaroo.
Hootaroo, Money Miners.
The information contained in this episode of Money of Mine is of general nature only and does not take into account the objectives, financial situation, or needs of any particular person. Before making any investment decision, you should consult with your financial advisor and consider how appropriate the advice is to your objectives, financial situation, and needs.